You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, the first case of the novel coronavirus was confirmed in Wisconsin last week. So when, if ever, should you use a face mask? We'll find out what public health experts have to say. First, Aldo Leopold is probably the name that first comes to mind when people think of wildlife conservation and Wisconsin. But as we're about to hear, there are many more naturalists who have played big roles in the effort to study, preserve, improve, and communicate about the natural world here in Wisconsin. Sumner Madison, an ecologist with the Wisconsin DNR, started recording interviews with some of our state's naturalists while he spent time with them in the field beginning 40 years ago. Madison has compiled these interviews along with some of the naturalists' own writings in a new book. It's called A Field, Portraits of Wisconsin Naturalists, Empowering Leopold's Legacy, Volume 1. Sumner joins us in the studio. Welcome back to Central Time.
Pleasure to be here, Rob.
Well, this is the product of a lot of work. What first led you 40-ish years ago to say, hey, I need to capture these naturalists in their own voices?
Yeah, at the age of 27, Sigurd Olsen, well-known writer at the time, invited me up to his cabin on Listening Point. So I spent a day with him, talked to him about his life with my Marantz portable tape recorder, and I got kind of the idea coming away from that it would be great to talk to other naturalists. I should say that, however, this idea probably originated when I was a high school student.
Wow.
And at one point, I thought, what would it be like to sit around a campfire and talk with John Muir about his life? So its origins go quite far back.
Most of the naturalists you profile, you were able to talk to, we have some of their more recent writings. You go back a little further, though, to people like Increase Lapham, who we hear through the voice of letters he wrote to his family members.
Right. Some people think I was around at that time as well. But, yeah, I started with Increase. He was really the first pioneering naturalist, a self-trained ecologist, if you will. And he was really a remarkable individual coming to this place, coming to Wisconsin before it was a state back in 1836. And he has just some remarkable anecdotes, remarkable stories about the times. And I forgot, although I, you know, you know that the times were so much different. But I basically forgot that the mode of transportation was by horseback, by stagecoach, and then later by train, and also the level of the life expectancy was quite short, late 40s, 49, 48, 49. And infant mortality was very high, and the Lapham family was certainly not immune to that.
Now, in just a couple of moments, I'll ask you to give a reading from in the voice of one of the people you talked to. But I want to talk about kind of the mental toolkit of the naturalist. It keeps coming up again and again, this love for the natural landscape of Wisconsin in this case, but also this incredible eye for detail and rigor and ability in many cases to draw or describe it with amazing precision. What goes into being a naturalist?
Yeah, so I would say in the book there are probably three takeaway themes. One is that early exposure interactions with the outdoors were pivotal to influencing a naturalist's path. Secondly, a guiding influence or mentor and or literature read early on were important to encouraging or fostering a career or avocation as a naturalist. And thirdly, each possessed really an unquenchable curiosity for and desire to know more about Wisconsin's natural history. But as part of that, I guess three threads. One is that each one is definitely an accurate and meticulous field observer. Mm-hmm. Secondly, an inspired, tenacious worker, and thirdly, and very importantly, an effective and influential communicator.
Well, let's give a listen to one of them now. You've got a reading for us from George Knutson. Set us up a little bit about George Knutson and his role in the history of naturalism in Wisconsin.
Sure. George grew up north of the Wisconsin Dells near Easton, and so he observed natural history at the Wisconsin Dells when his family moved closer to the river. And he was actually asked to lead individuals on tours. He was quite well known for his turtle collection and his insect collection. He was a longtime observer of natural history on his own, but then he became involved with the Department of Natural Resources. And between the 1950s and early 1960s, he studied black bears and beaver and otter. And I'd like to read to you one of his favorite stories about black bears.
About bears, yes.
One of my favorite stories involves a bear at the Dairy Farm Resort up by Boulder Junction. There was a dump right behind the resort that bears used, so we thought we'd come up and try to live trap around the dump. They were open dumps in those days. The tourists staying at the resort knew we were coming somehow. People came up to tell us about the big tracks, the little tracks, about the weight of this one and that one. We told them that maybe we would come back in a few days and set one of our big culvert traps. So we did. We drove in. The tourists saw us coming, and the whole dang bunch got into their cars. Some walked down from the resort down to the dump. We must have had 15 to 20 people down there. When we approached the dump, there was a bear there that was a pretty tame old gal. I turned to Dewey. Dewey was his field assistant, nicknamed Dewey. His real name was Alvin Yeager. I turned to Dewey and said, "Gosh, there's only that one tree. Maybe if I chase her up that tree, you know, maybe she'd go up there and we can get her without even trapping her." So I took off out of the truck. People started yelling and clapping. Me after the bear. The bear scootered up, out and up the dang tree just as nice as could be. So here's the bear sitting up in the tree with no trap, nothing to keep the bear from coming down. But when there's a crowd like that, you know, and you've got a chance to get a bear for free, I thought, heck, it's worth a chance. So I climbed up under this bear with my needle and got right up under her fanny and gave her a little shot. And I have to just pause here and say that this was before there were tranquilizing guns. So this was a hypodermic needle at the end of a long stick.
So you got to get kind of close to the bear.
Yeah. She blew at me, and I thought, boy, if she starts climbing down, she's going to use me as part of that tree. But she just stayed up there, and pretty soon she started quivering. Well, then she started slipping, and down she came right beside me. She was a big one, probably about 180 pounds. I put my arm around her, and both the bear and I skidded down that tree. Those people watching had eyeballs that big watching me, a big Norwegian coming down the tree with that bear. Of course, I couldn't hold 180 pounds. It was mostly a scrambling fall for about 15 feet. The bear was out when we got down there. I was a big hero that day. From that time on, every time I was up in that country club area, people would say, "There's the guy that climbed the tree and got that live bear."
Story from George Knutson, told in Sumner Madison's book, A Field, Portraits of Wisconsin Naturalists, Empowering Leopold's Legacy, Volume 1. Sumner, we're not all going to get out in all weather and be naturalists in the middle of nowhere. We're not all going to climb up that tree, I hope, with the bear. But part of your hope here, I think, is to inspire us to think like naturalists, maybe even in our own backyard.
Yes, I think for young people especially, and people really of all ages, it's very important to get out and to take time, to spend time with nature, to observe as much as they can interactions in the wild between animals, and to observe and to take note of what plants are out there. I think this is a way of enriching one's life. And this book is really, I think, hopefully will inspire people to take stock of our conservation history.
Hey, I wanted to talk about that. We've only touched on a couple of the many names and stories you share in the book. Can you talk about the value of going back and meeting these naturalists from throughout Wisconsin's history?
Yeah, I just wanted to mention them. In addition to Increase Lapham, there was Francis Zerr, George Knudsen, as we've mentioned, Jim Zimmerman, Ruth Hine, Francis and Frederick Hammerstrom, Sam Robbins, George Becker, Lori Otto, Francis Hole, Bill Volkert, Leroy Lentour, Lois Nestle, Marion Moran, Joseph Martin Rose, Michael Van Stappen, Eric Epstein, and, of course, Sigurd Olsen. These are 19 of 49 individuals. This is going to be a three-volume project.
Wow.
So I'm in the middle of writing volume two. But each of these individuals, some known, some not that well known, all have stories to tell. And indigenous people have known for millennia the importance of storytelling and how it really conveys one's history and one's legacy.
So are you working on Volume 2 now as we speak?
I'm working on Volume 2 as we speak.
And you must have so much tape, we call it in the radio business. I guess some of it's probably literally tape still.
Well, the most challenging person in the next chapter is Hugh Iltis, a well-known plant ecologist, very well-known back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. My interview with him comprised basically 30 90-minute tapes.
Wow.
I have to transcribe those and pick out the selections from that from those recordings.
A lot to look forward to there. Sumner, I'm sure we'll talk to you about Volume 2 and Volume 3, but I hope you'll come back and we'll meet some of the other naturalists in Volume 1 still.
Absolutely, you bet.
That's Sumner Madison. We talked to him today about his new book. It's called A Field, Portraits of Wisconsin Naturalists, Empowering Leopold's Legacy, Volume 1. Sumner's going to read from the book, by the way, Friday, February 21st at 7:30 p.m. at Village Booksmith in Baraboo. Coming up, we'll talk about whether or not face masks have any medical benefit against viruses like the novel coronavirus that's in the news after the first case was confirmed here in Wisconsin last week. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, personality tests can be fun to take, and reading the results can make you feel like you learn a little bit about yourself. But a personality psychologist tells us some of the most popular tests don't really tell us that much about who we are. Now, the first case of the novel coronavirus was confirmed in Wisconsin last week. The State Department of Public Health says the risk of being infected with that specific virus is low. But you might be wondering whether you should use a face mask to protect yourself from that or flu or other diseases. Our colleagues at WisContext did a deep dive into face masks this week, looking at whether they work, who should wear them, and under what circumstances. Will Cushman is associate editor of WisContext. He talked to WPR host Keely Baltina earlier today.
First of all, yes or no question, do we need face masks to protect us from the novel coronavirus?
According to the World Health Organization and the CDC, the answer in most cases is no. You do not need a face mask to protect yourself against the novel coronavirus.
Then why do we see pictures of people wearing face masks, especially in China?
Sure. There are, in the World Health Organization's guidelines, they do acknowledge that there are cultural differences in the use of face masks to prevent infectious diseases. Depending on where you are in the world, those cultural practices might be different. In China, it seems that it's much more common to wear face masks. In fact, I think right now it's actually the government is compelling citizens to wear face masks.
But the World Health Organization says physically it does not protect you from the virus.
If you're not sick and in public settings, yeah, they say it's not really, there isn't scientific evidence to support wearing a face mask.
Electronics giant Foxconn actually switched part of its production in China to making surgical masks. So clearly Foxconn thinks that there's demand there. Do we know if we're seeing more people here in Wisconsin buy face masks?
We are. I mean, at least anecdotally, we've noticed a few Walgreens stores in Madison have been sold out at various times, sold out of face masks. And I talked to Walgreens corporate PR people who said that they are seeing rising demand. They didn't say necessarily where, but kind of like across the board, there is a rise in demand for face masks worldwide.
We often see face masks at the doctor's office, at clinics. They're at the you know, beginning when you walk in so that if people are sick, they can put them on. What could a spike on the consumer side of demand mean for the healthcare industry?
Some healthcare professionals are concerned about this demand or this spike in demand reducing the flow of very needed face masks in healthcare settings. So face masks for healthcare workers who are working with people, treating people who have infectious diseases and don't want to catch those, not only the novel coronavirus, but influenza and other infectious diseases. And then also masks for people who are sick, who need them sometimes to help them prevent the spread of whatever disease they're dealing with.
Do we know if certain masks are better at protecting certain kinds of viruses?
There are masks that are better at generally protecting against infectious diseases. I'm not sure about specific viruses, but there's a mask called an N95 mask. It's actually a respirator, essentially, and that has a very tight seal. It fits very tightly around your face versus like a typical surgical mask, which is kind of loose around your face. The N95 masks or respirators are generally only recommended for healthcare workers. In fact, I spoke with an official at UW Hospitals here in Madison, and she said that their staff have to undergo training to use an N95 mask and to make sure that they're able to handle it because it is quite uncomfortable to wear, especially for long periods of time.
And that seems to play into this, the fact that you spoke to a medical official who said there are three things to think about when you're deciding whether to wear a face mask. And one of them is what kind of face mask you might need and based on what's out there.
Right. Yep. So the N95 masks are recommended for healthcare workers who are working with treating someone who has an unknown infectious disease. Surgical masks are recommended for folks who have respiratory symptoms, coughing, sneezing, and then maybe also a fever, and they're not sure what those symptoms are related to. They haven't been diagnosed with a specific disease yet. So they'll often be asked, especially right now with all the unknowns around the novel coronavirus, to wear a face mask at the doctor's office just to help prevent the spread of droplets, respiratory droplets, which is what diseases like influenza and we think novel coronavirus spread.
And you actually touched on another element of those three that the medical official laid out, which is, you know, you have to think about what's important when it comes to who's wearing the mask.
Yes, yes. So it's definitely masks are not generally recommended for asymptomatic people, so people who are healthy, who feel healthy, especially in public settings. Even if you're going to a doctor's office and you're healthy, they probably will not recommend that you wear a face mask right now, just because there isn't the scientific evidence to support that it really helps you not catch a disease.
And so that's the third element, the setting, figuring out the environment in which you will be and if you really need it to protect yourself or to protect others.
Exactly. Yeah. So in a healthcare setting, if you are showing respiratory symptoms, you probably will be asked to wear or likely will be asked to wear a mask. And that is to protect usually the healthcare workers who are treating you, because you are in a close setting. They'll be examining you and you'll be within just a foot or two of each other. So it's when you're in those kind of close contact settings is when face masks are more recommended.
Will Cushman is the associate editor of WisConText, and we're talking to him about his reporting about face masks and the novel coronavirus. And, Will, we should point out we're using the phrase novel coronavirus because that's what's familiar to us right now. But the virus actually now has a more specific name that you use in your WisConText article.
It does, yeah. So there were some various names floating around. In addition to just kind of the typical novel coronavirus that I think a lot of people are familiar with, it was originally being called the 2019-CoV virus, which is
A mouthful
uh-huh. For the radio, yeah. But now the World Health Organization has designated the virus SARS-CoV-2, and then the disease that it causes as COVID, so that's COVID-19 for 2019, which is the year that it arose.
So a different name for the virus itself and then a name for the disease that people can experience when they're infected with the virus.
Exactly. And we're not sure if those names may change again.
Certainly, as we see this develop and change and spread or even eventually get a handle on it for sure.
Totally.
Back to masks. Sometimes we see branded fashion masks from time to time. How effective are those? Do they come with other risks?
The healthcare official I spoke to was really not into fashion face masks or reusable face masks in general.
Because you think, well, it's more sustainable, right, to be able to wash something instead of throwing it out.
Sure. Yeah. Yep. So that could be a reason why people might want to buy one of those. Also, because if you buy one face mask, you don't have to keep buying more and more disposable ones. So it could potentially be cheaper in the long term as well. The problem problem with those reusable face masks is that they're incredibly difficult to clean. Even if you run them through the laundry, like, you're not guaranteed that they're going to be free of pathogens. And most people are not super fastidious when, or at least as fastidious as they need to be when they're cleaning things like their clothes. And so really the face mask can be more problematic and actually cause you to potentially catch a disease, whether it's an infectious disease or something from bacteria, rather than like protecting you against diseases.
So no fashion face masks, even not necessarily face masks if you don't have symptoms. So what kind of things do people do to protect themselves?
The number one recommendation right now is, I think people have heard it year after year, to protect yourself against the common cold and influenza is to wash your hands. So with warm water and soap, sing happy birthday to yourself or sing the ABCs to yourself, and that should be about long enough. Otherwise, social distancing is something that people can do if they're really concerned about catching a disease, especially if you're immunocompromised. So keeping yourself out of public settings, places sure. where a lot of people mix is also a good idea.
And we just learned that UW-Madison plans to do research on the novel coronavirus. Give us a glimpse into what you know about that.
Correct. Yeah, there are a few researchers at UW-Madison who are going to be looking at how the novel coronavirus spreads between, like, how the mechanisms by which it spreads. And they also want to develop or understand, identify like a good animal model for modeling how the disease works in humans. So right now there isn't an animal model for understanding those effects. And they're actually using a sample of the virus from the patient in Dane County who was confirmed to have the virus last week.
So we're at the very beginning stages of that research here in Wisconsin.
Correct.
All right. Well, thank you for your time today.
Thanks so much.
That was WPR host Keeley Baltina talking to WisConText's Will Cushman about his latest piece, The Novel Coronavirus, Face Masks, and When to Use Them. You can find that article online at wiscontext.org. Coming up after the news, do you know what four-letter combo you are according to the Myers-Briggs Type Indicator? Well, a lot of people love to take personality quizzes and assessments. Our guest says they may not be as accurate or useful as we might think they are. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we try to clear up some possible election confusion here in Wisconsin with tens of thousands of absentee voters receiving two ballots for the spring election. And it's not a mistake. First, do you enjoy taking personality tests? Maybe you know your four-letter Myers-Briggs result by memory, or maybe, on a less serious note, you get sucked into taking quizzes like, what kind of flower are you, on places like BuzzFeed? They're often marketed to us as ways to improve our lives and our performance. Some employers even require staff to take some of the more serious personality tests and share the results. Some people even take the results and types very seriously, including them on resumes or dating profiles. But what if those results simply aren't accurate? What if they're not all they're cracked up to be? Jennifer Fayard is a personality psychologist and assistant professor of psychology at Ouachita Baptist University in Arkansas. She writes an online column for Psychology Today called People Are Strange. Her piece about personality tests called False Portraits is in the January edition of Psychology Today. Jennifer, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, professors sometimes ask classes to take them. Employers require employees to take things like Myers-Briggs, and then there are the more fun charts. What do we love about taking these tests so much?
Well, there's several things I think that draw us to personality tests in the first place. And I mean, I'll admit it, they're really fun.
Yeah.
Even though I know there's no validity to the what cheese are you test, I still take the what cheese are you test. For the record, I got mozzarella and I was highly offended.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of reasons. One, we're inherently interested in people, including ourselves. And I know a lot of people struggle with fitting in and wondering if there are other people like them, and having a way to sort of categorize yourself can be something that makes you feel a little bit less alone in the world. We like to be able to figure out other people, and if there's a convenient system for understanding other people, that's helpful. But in general, I haven't met a person yet who has not enjoyed taking these tests. It seems to be pretty universal.
Let's look at one of the most well-known ones. A lot of people have taken the Myers-Briggs type indicator on their own, or maybe as I have at a workplace. It comes out with this four-letter result like INTP or ISTJ or whatever. Can you talk about what goes into the Myers-Briggs test? What is it claiming, at least, to figure out about us?
So the Myers-Briggs test is a little bit of an offshoot of Carl Jung's theory of personality. It's changed things up just a little bit. It's not exactly what Jung proposed. But basically what they're looking at is cognitive functions. They claim that it's looking at effectively the way you prefer to process the world, that you have four levels of preferences, one that's primary, the rest that sort of follow from there, and whether you are introverted or extroverted basically involves, in this system, whether you direct your energy toward using these cognitive functions inwardly or outwardly. And so depending on this combination of letters, they would propose that you would interact with the world in sort of characteristic ways.
And people really take this seriously sometimes. I mean, there are whole message boards, I think, devoted to one of those combination of four letters.
Absolutely.
Employers, as I mentioned, use it. Why did this one in particular, do you think, get so popular?
Honestly, I think it's marketing. They have marketed things very, very well. As you mentioned, a lot of corporations use it. And so, you know, once something becomes popular, sometimes it's popular because it's popular. So I think more than anything, it really has to do with the marketing angle.
Where do you see it falling short? You, and I should say a lot of other psychological researchers,
right,
see a test like Myers-Briggs falling short.
Well, there's a lot of layers to that answer. So for one, the test itself has a lot of issues. A lot of people who have taken the Myers-Briggs have reported that they take it one time. Let's say they get INTJ. They take it another time, a couple years later. They get ENTP, which is a completely different personality type. And so it sort of raises the question, did they actually change that much? If these are things that are supposed to be, you know, relatively consistent, did they actually change that much? Or is the system that they use to type, you know, maybe not as effective? There's also some issues with validity or whether it's really measuring what it's supposed to measure well. A lot of studies have looked at different life outcomes. There's been more literature probably than anything on workplace outcomes, since it is so frequently used in the workplace, basically to see whether this test, you know, these different types do actually predict workplace performance, especially with leadership and managerial positions. And the evidence is not great on that front. It doesn't tend to do what it's supposed to do. Some of the issues come from the way the test is constructed, the way it's scored, and we have what's called a forced choice format on the Myers-Briggs. So if you've ever taken a personality inventory that's not the Myers-Briggs, you might have noticed that you answer a single question, usually on a continuum from 1, strongly disagree, to 5, strongly agree, or something similar. What the Myers-Briggs does instead is you have two different, qualitatively different options to choose from. So I tend to, and then you have option A and then option B, which is a completely different behavior, and you choose one of those things. And I know a lot of people, when faced with that forced choice format, could easily have given either one of those as an answer. You have to pick one, and it ends up with sort of a strange scoring system in a lot of ways that seems to miss a lot of information.
Talking to personality psychologist Jennifer Fayard from Ouachita Baptist University in Arkansas. She wrote a piece in Psychology Today about personality testing and the downside sometimes thereof. Now, you also wrote, Jennifer, about one that I was not familiar with, the Enneagram test. That sounds like a lot of people use this, too. What is that?
So the Enneagram is a system that has been around for a little while. I had heard references to it on and off for quite a while. It's recently become more popularized. I forget the author off the top of my head. I apologize. Recently wrote a book called The Road Back to You, which sort of revived this Enneagram system. And it's a setup where you have 1 through 9 numerals that correspond to different types. And the Enneagram claims to look more at motivation than anything, but gives very similar descriptions of the types to what you might see in the Myers-Briggs, where it talks about what you might do across different situations. It's a little bit more complicated than that. There's also what are called wings, and these are numbers that you embody some of those characteristics as well, perhaps in different situations. But this has, again, become popular pretty recently. My students in particular have been very interested in this, and so I get a lot of questions about, have you taken the Enneagram? Have you taken the Enneagram? And I try to hold off at least until I get to know them a little bit better on my personality test rant.
Well, the weird thing is we've got these tests and others that are pretty widely used, at least in popular culture and the business world. But as you write, there is one that psychologists actually use and think holds up pretty well, a lot of research around it, but isn't widely used. Can you tell us what the professionals in the field are actually doing to try to get a handle on the variations of human personality?
Right. We have a trait taxonomy, a personality trait system called the Big Five. And this is 5 families of personality traits that research has shown tend to describe most or a lot of, you know, what people do, how people think, how people feel on a consistent basis. And the Big Five is very, very widely used by personality psychologists. We have not marketed it very well, whereas Myers-Briggs has, you know, cornered the neighborhood on marketing, but then personality psychologists don't use the Myers-Briggs. So there's a little bit of a disconnect between what the researchers do and what's very popular.
Tell us a little bit about the kind of things we might measure in the system that psychologists, personality psychologists actually use.
Yeah, so the Big Five are extroversion, agreeableness, conscientiousness, emotional stability, sometimes also referred to as neuroticism, and openness to experience, sometimes referred to as intellect. And so an acronym that a lot of people use to remember these is OCEAN or CANOE, depending on whether you're an outdoor adventurer. But extroversion has to do with sociability. This is something that we're all pretty familiar with, I think, through pop culture, but also looking at things like your energy level, being dominant and assertive, being enthusiastic, and things like that. Those traits, those qualities tend to kind of cluster together in people. This is why the Big Five are big. It's sort of a collection of related traits. Agreeableness, if you boil it down to a single word, would be niceness. People who are agreeable tend to be pretty trusting, tend to be pretty cooperative, sympathetic. Openness to experience is being very open to ideas, enjoying new things, maybe even aesthetic or intellectual pursuits. If you're emotionally stable, you're calm, you're collected, you don't react very, very strongly to potentially stressful stimuli. And then conscientious people tend to be very responsible, self-controlled, organized, things like that. So we've got a range of traits that really cover, again, a lot of our human experience.
We're talking to Jennifer Fayard, assistant professor of psychology at Ouachita Baptist University in Arkansas. She wrote a piece in Psychology Today about personality testing and where a lot of the popular ones may fall short. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you like taking personality tests? Why or why not? Do you find them fun? Do you find them useful in understanding yourself? Is there a personality test you've taken that you want to ask our guest about? Has an employer ever required you to take one? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Jennifer Fayard, a personality psychologist and assistant professor of psychology at Ouachita Baptist University in Arkansas. She wrote a piece called False Portraits about personality testing. It's in Psychology Today, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you taken personality tests? What did you learn about yourself, do you think? Do you find the results useful, or do you find this just kind of fun? Have you done this because an employer required it or recommended it? Or as an employer, do you have your employees take personality tests? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Say, you know, when I was in my 20s and the 1980s, I utilized the Myers-Briggs with others. Of course, we were doing clinical work with residents who were developmentally disabled adults, and the executive director had us take the test. So we were able to identify in each other what our strengths and weaknesses were, mm-hmm. because we worked with different adults differently. And in our different responsibilities, we did take the test more than once. And yes, those results were found on a spectrum. So like you might be an INFP, but you're a P by only 1 or 2 points. And
right.
if you're in a different situation, you might be a T or, you know, a J by 1 point. So you might switch, but it might only be by 1 or 2 points because it's on a spectrum. But in a clinical situation, it was a very helpful test and very effective for our residents. It was a very positive that Myers-Briggs has a very positive use in clinical field.
Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. And I wonder, Jennifer, even if the scientific rigor isn't there, just the fact of a conversation starter to talk about how our personalities at the workplace are, we might be able to get something good out of it, as Jeff seems to have done.
I agree, and I think that a lot of people have found it useful in that way as well. One of the things that I mentioned in the article is that, you know, even if there are some problems here, this can give people a language and sort of a shorthand for beginning to talk about differences that might be important. And so the Myers-Briggs is not completely without value, right? If we rely on it too much to sort of explain everything that we do, we might have some issues because it's really not capturing things very accurately. But it can, as you said, be a conversation starter and at least help us try to organize our own perceptions of ourselves that maybe we haven't figured out how to communicate to other people or even how to articulate to ourselves.
Jeff, thanks for that call. We'll go to Rachel calling from Racine now. Rachel, hello.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about, Rachel?
Well, I used to work at GE, and they had all of us take the DISC personality test. And what they had us do is we took the DISC test, and then you had to post what the DISC test tells you is what your personality type is normally, and then what your personality type is under stressful situations. And they had us post in our cubicles, you know, what your personality type is and what it is under stress. And it was supposed to help you interact with other people.
Did it help you, Rachel?
Yeah, there was a gal on my team that I didn't really get along with. We just didn't click. And I was an I with a D under stress, and she was a D, so she liked the short, succinct answers to questions that she asked. So when I saw that she was a D, I knew how to approach her, and then we became really great work friends.
Huh. Rachel, thanks. That's what I've never even heard of, Jennifer. I guess there's a lot out there, but yeah, posting it in the cubicle even.
Yes, definitely. So I have heard of the DISC system that seems to be becoming a little bit more popular. And it has some things that actually overlap a decent amount with the Big Five, interestingly. I think the under stress thing is a really interesting thing. And I've not seen that as part of the DISC results before. And one thing that the Enneagram does as well is talk about under stress. And so, of course, there are individual differences in how people respond under stress. But for the most part, it's all going to be pretty negative. And so we're not going to be our best selves for sure when we're under stress. And so, you know, understanding maybe characteristic things that you do under stress could be really helpful. I have not, however, seen a test that really captures that. So I would be really interested to see sort of what that looks like and how that's assessed.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Jennifer Fayard is with us from Ouachita Baptist University in Arkansas, talking about personality tests, their popularity, and where some of them can fall short. Before I go back to our callers, Jennifer, I wonder if there's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy with personality tests. Like my Myers-Briggs came back that I'm a big introvert, which is mostly true. But some people go with lean into that and say, okay, that means I'm going to give myself space to stay out of things. But some of my best things in life come when I get out of that introvert zone and do extroverty type stuff. So do we risk hemming ourselves in if we believe too strongly in our results?
I think to some extent, yeah. So when we get a result like that, if we really do believe in it, that will be a lens through which we interpret our own behavior and think about our own behavior, possibly even direct our own behavior. And one of the things that we see with things like the Myers-Briggs and the Enneagram is a sense of confirmation bias. So you get a type, you read the description, you suddenly see yourself very clearly in that type, because we may not be paying attention to all of our behaviors equally once we have this kind of guiding framework for looking at ourselves. And so I think it can definitely influence sort of how we do things in the future if we think we really are this type.
Let's go back to our callers. Jeff joins us now in Madison. Jeff, hello.
Yeah.
What'd you want to bring up, Jeff?
Oh, hi. I was going to just I agree with your guess that Myers-Briggs' greatest success may be in marketing the belief that test takers have a set personality type. I used to do it. I've read research that showed that a group of people were given retested 3 weeks later after their Myers-Briggs test, and 60% of them had a completely different personality type.
Yes, yes.
Thanks, Jeff, for the call. And Jennifer, that's a point you make in your piece on this. Personalities do change, but it tends to be over the course of years, not 3 weeks, as the caller just mentioned.
Right. Typically, change happens pretty slow. There, of course, could be a major life event that could, you know, speed that up a little bit more drastically. We do change over time, but if you take it 3 weeks later, you shouldn't have changed enough to completely change personality types.
Thanks for the call. Time for one more caller, I think. Rick joins us in Madison. Rick, hello.
Hello.
What did you want to tell us about, Rick?
I worked with a coffee shop chain, a small one, and we actually went through a company in Texas and had a personality profile developed for any specific job in the company. In this case, it was for baristas. And so we pre-identified characteristics that we were most looking for, and then a personality test was custom developed for the company. And then it was used. And we just found it amazingly accurate and helpful. It would come up with a description of the individual, you know, after they had responded to maybe, I would say, 100 questions or so. Mm-hmm. It would take them maybe 20 minutes. And but the results were incredibly accurate. And even for the individuals that took it, we always promised that they could see the results and they would come back and simply be kind of amazed at how well it described them.
Rick, thanks for the call. We just have a few moments left. Jennifer, have you heard of the custom personality test for a particular job?
I haven't. I'm sure there are companies that produce those types of things. I'd like to just make a note on the comment that he made about how accurate it felt. And they do often feel very, very accurate. And there's a few reasons for that, if we have time to talk about that quick.
Just briefly, yeah.
Sure. I mentioned confirmation bias. When we hear a description, we can suddenly see the characteristics that fit that description pop out a little bit more, and maybe we pay a little bit less attention to aspects of ourselves that don't fit very well. And another phenomenon that we see with personality feedback on these types of tests is often that feedback is almost entirely positive, and that increases our tendency to accept it as opposed to really think about it critically. So I'm not sure what the feedback was on that one personality test. I'd be very interested in that. But that's a reason that sometimes it feels like they've really nailed us when, in fact, there's some things missing and it's maybe pretty general.
Jennifer, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Jennifer Fayard, personality psychologist and assistant professor of psychology at Ouachita Baptist University in Arkansas. She wrote a piece on personality testing in the January edition of Psychology Today magazine. We've got a link to it up at our website, wpr.org/centraltime. You can still share your thoughts, maybe your experiences in the world of personality testing for good or ill. You can do that over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You might have seen this in the news. Target stores, you know, Target, they printed some University of Minnesota apparel to sell in the appropriate region. They're onesies they were for babies. And they had the M for Minnesota, the maroon and gold colors, and the words, Minnesota, wait for it, Badgers. Yes, the Minnesota Badgers. When the error was spotted, Target released a brief statement, quote, color us red. As a Minnesota-based company, we know we are home to the Gophers. That's as in the Golden Gophers, the actual Minnesota mascot, not the Badgers, which many of our listeners might know as the mascot of the University of Wisconsin and the official state animal of Wisconsin. I guess the question here is who, if anyone, should feel insulted? Is this, you know, a big flex by Minnesota trying to grab the Badger identity? Is it Badger infiltration into Golden Gopher territory? One response, the UW-Madison Police Department Twitter feed says, quote, we've opened up a full investigation into this matter, end quote. Whatever your answer is to those questions, I think one thing's clear. If you get your hand on some of these onesies, you've got quite a collector's item. Maybe a good thing for, you know, a mixed family of Badger and Gopher fans. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.